Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, favorite guest, I think, and favorite person of many of us here in Chapel Hill is Fred Tiger.
He is
the writer, researcher, American Civil War expert, of course, teaching classes at the University of North Carolina for the Alumni Association, leading everybody in Chapel Hill knows somebody who's been on a trip with Freddie. And we know him best at WCHL as Mr. Trivia. But Fred Tiger, welcome.
Thank you, DG. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
It's a treat to be with you, too. What I wondered about as you and I were visiting the other day and you were getting ready to teach sort of the last class in the series of Civil War, the great Civil War series that you've done and the trips that you've taken, as the 150th anniversary and look back at the Civil War, as our look back kind of concludes, as you had a class the other day on sort of what the post-Civil War, the immediate post-Civil War was like in North Carolina. So are you glad that it's all over?
No, DG, actually. And in fact, to be quite honest, we have one more, if you will, semester, which will be next fall, in which we will close off the period of Reconstruction, which lasted, of course, from 1865 to 1877. And we'll close that off with a look at the last couple of chapters, if you will, nationally, focusing on the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, a native of Raleigh, North Carolina, and then the very controversial election of 1876, and the return of most of the southern states, all of the southern states that were formerly a part of the Confederacy, back to, as they referred to their redeemed state, back to local control. And that came after the election of Rutherford B. Hayes. So there'll be a class to take care of that nationally. There'll be a class to take care of Reconstruction to that same period within the state of North Carolina. And the class that you and I were chatted about last week was Reconstruction in the Village here in Chapel Hill. And there is no question the University of North Carolina was a political football during all the thrust and parries of Reconstruction politics.
Well, let's talk about the local aspects of it. We know kind of vaguely that the university, while staying open during the Civil War, had to close after the Civil War, and the reopening of it was sort of – why did we have to close, and how did we get back open again?
That's a great question. The lecture covered 2 hours. Do we have that much time?
Yeah, for you.
Kind. DG, UNC was caught between those who believed it was a bastion of the same aristocracy that led the South and North Carolina into war. And then there were others who believed it was just on the other side of the fence in the other direction. UNC couldn't win. David Lowery Swain, who was the president of the university at that time, former governor of North Carolina, caught quite a bit of heat because on the instructions of Zebulon Vance, our war governor, Swain and another former governor of North Carolina, William A. Graham, those two gentlemen, Swain and Graham, were asked to move east of Raleigh, have a face-to-face meeting with William Sherman, who was headed this direction, and to, if you will, conduct a separate peace. Not necessarily a separate peace, but to try to establish the conditions by which Raleigh might be saved and by which the university might be saved.
Might not burn down by
exactly,
Sherman
by any destruction. There are those Confederates who believe that Swain and Graham and even Vance sold the Confederacy out, even though the Confederacy was on its last legs. Jefferson Davis certainly thought so. So you had those people, old Confederates, believing that Swain and the university shortchanged them, caught them by surprise. And then you had an element, the new Reconstruction Republican parties, that were believing that UNC was nothing more than a hotbed of the old aristocrats who dragged us unwillingly into an American Civil War that killed and destroyed so very much in our state. Swain eventually stepped down from the presidency. Our new governor, Holden, W.W. Holden, who wanted to open the university, to make it the people's university, had the ability to change a policy, thanks to the new North Carolina Constitution in 1868, to appoint the new president and trustees. And so he appointed Solomon Poole from down east, and Poole and Holden both wanted to come in and open the university to be, quite honest, we would probably in this day and time applaud the efforts of Holden and Poole for wanting to open the doors of the university to anybody and everybody.
Reconstruction
Republicans.
Folks that we would almost say were imposed on us from the outside because of the transformation of our government.
And I think that's exactly the point of contention. And many North Carolinians believe that Holden and Poole were elements of the Union victory, were the Reconstruction.
What we called scalawags.
Oh, yeah. Scalawags to someone in the South, exactly. They would not be carpetbaggers. That term was reserved for those who came north with their belongings in their carpet bag. But here in the state, here in Chapel Hill, here in the area, there were several people, Swain for a while, Vance, Cornelia Phillips Spencer, quite active in taking the pen and writing articles to attack very early the administration of Solomon Poole while president of the University of North Carolina, and to go after Holden until he was turned out of office. We had to wait and to see how long Poole's administration would go on here in Chapel Hill, but it was very, very unpopular and eventually led to a temporary closing of only a month or so, but then a much longer closing for the university.
Why did it close?
It's hard to have the funds to run a university when no one's paying tuition. Student population dropped to under 30, under 40. Ridiculous as far as in terms of today when we're talking about 29, 30,000 students. And it brings it to a point in terms of relativity, DG. Before the American Civil War, we had some 465 students at the University of North Carolina. And that was, as far as an institution, a university in the entire country, the second most, only behind Yale. But of course, the American Civil War took care of that. The university did stay open throughout the war. Graduations were reduced through those years to one or two or three. But when Poole came in, there was a reaction to that, he being an extension of Reconstruction Republican politics, and no one came. And it's hard to have the funding to run a university when no one's paying tuition.
Was there a specific decision, someone who decided to close it, or did it just kind of run out of steam?
Eventually, the decision was to terminate faculty positions, to terminate Poole's regime, and that was in part thanks to another governor, a Democrat who took over office after William Holden. And the decision was made without a faculty, without a president, to shut down and reboot, if you will. Mm-hmm. So the university closed from February, the 1st of February, 1871, and did not open until September of 1875. Tough times because, DG, at that particular time, the town and village of Chapel Hill was only as thriving as the University of North Carolina. The two were married at the hip. And
almost still.
Well, it's still very much that way. You're exactly. But even more so then. In fact, it got to the point that when the university was doing so poorly and faculty was receiving so little pay, that there were merchants here in Chapel Hill who refused to extend credit for the faculty members who taught at UNC. And they only numbered 4, 5, 6, or 7. There were not that many as well. We would not even recognize the University of North Carolina in the late 1860s and certainly in the 1870s in the first part of that decade.
Well, when I first came to Chapel Hill, there was a remembrance, an extended remembrance of the bell ringing that took place when the university opened. And there hadn't been as much talk about that lately as there used to be. What was that, and why don't we talk about it too much?
That's a great question. Well, first part of your question, Cornelia Phillips Spencer, who penned hundreds of articles in newspapers and magazines and what have you, attacking Poole's administration, attacking Holden's administration, calling for a return to a university that she remembered. She had family members who taught here at the University of North Carolina. Phillips Hall is named for her people. Eventually, with the return of Democrats to power in the state government, and with the remembrance of Morrill Act money by which NC State and many schools that were originally A&Ms and now are the Oklahoma States, the NC States, and what have you, money was found that would allow the university to pay some $7,500 of the $11,000 that it was in debt. And with that start, with the passage of that bill to allow that money to be used for the university, it was March the 20th, 1875. And the folks over in Raleigh, as soon as that bill passed, and it only passed the House by one vote, someone went over to the telegraph office, pounded out a message to Cornelia Phillips Spencer over here in Chapel Hill, right here on Franklin Street. She got the message, completely overwhelmed with joy and elation that the University of North Carolina would have a chance to find a second life, to be reborn, if you will. She gathered her own child, a couple of other neighborhood children, and off she went walking from her house, which is the Spencer Love home on Franklin Street, cut across the Chapel of the Cross grounds, made her way through the weed-choked McCorkle place. Andrew Mickle, who was the bursar of the university and had been a merchant in Chapel Hill, and also the man who had the keys to the university, joined up with her, and that small little party made their way up to South Building, which had fallen into ill repair, made their way to the top, and she latched onto that rope and began to ring the bell that had not been rung for 4 years to announce to the town that money had been found, enough that the university would have a foothold for attacking the debt and for knowing full well that within months the university had a chance to reopen, and it did in September. It was her birthday.
Oh.
And it was a very special time for a lady who spent some 69 years in Chapel Hill. Why do we not talk about it? Well, if you recall, DG, a few years ago we took her name from a scholarship. The sensitivity meter is pinned to one side right now, and there are those who still remember Cornelia Phillips Spencer as being someone who perhaps did not have the sensitivities and values that we embrace and that we hold in the 21st century.
So it was a part of the rebooting of our heroes in terms of assessing them not in terms of what the values were during their time, but more that our society today just simply cannot countenance a heroic label for anybody who happened to be a slaveholder or racist.
Or did not believe in the equality of the races or what have you. Yes.
visiting with Freddie Kiger, we're talking about his passion, which is Civil War and post-Civil War. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Fred Kiger. We're talking about Civil War, but I'm also talking about Fred Kiger. And Freddie can't talk about you without talking about the Civil War. What's the source of your love for teaching the rest of us and helping the rest of us understand?
It is a great question, and it is a strange topic to get one's head around and arms around, because it was without question a most tragic time in our history. Over 650,000 lives, and the number going up with the recent research going into records and pensions and what have you. One of every 50 Americans alive in 1860 is dead in 5 years. How many families touched, wrecked? So many Southern households in particular, because of the smaller manpower numbers touched by the war. The South, some $10 billion of property destruction. How did I get my arms around all of that in a war that accomplished two things? Preserved the Union and our Republican form of government, and ended an institution which I wish had been taken care of some 200, 300 years earlier. That's the biggest failing I have with our founding fathers and that time of history when we had opportunities with declarations of independence and constitutions to right a wrong that was so wrong. But how did I get passionate about all that? DG, I grew up at a time when the American Civil War was in its centennial. I was 8, 9, 10 years of age, and my mother bought me a Time Life magazine dedicated to the American Civil War. And I remember for hours upon hours, not necessarily reading the text, but looking at the artists and their portrayals of some of the major battles of the American Civil War. And they had some fine artists at Time Life. And I would gaze into the faces, and my imagination would run. That coupled with the fact that my father was in World War II, was one who landed at Omaha Beach, D plus 12, because a flood had taken his unit's equipment, or otherwise he would have been in some of the first waves. Now, the war caught up to him very shortly thereafter at St. Lo, when my father lost all of his innocence and war was introduced to him in all of its grim reality. But between going to my dad's reunions after the war and sitting in the back of those hotel rooms, those little convention conference halls in Beckley, West Virginia, and Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Cumberland Gap, Kentucky, and Columbia, South Carolina, and I listened to these men who were in his unit, the 331st Infantry Regiment, and they would tell these stories that I was absolutely captivated. I'd sit alone in the back of those rooms with all of that cigarette and cigar smoke, and with many of them blurry and bleary with drink. But even at that young age, I learned very quickly that they were talking about a time that was the common denominator of their existence. It was their universe and their relationship and their friendship and their brotherhood was the strongest of anything I have ever since experienced. They were passionate about how much they cared and loved one another after going through that experience. Their stories were incredible. So between the centennial and between listening to those stories, I began reading and reading and reading, and hope that even today when I try to talk about the American Civil War or those men, that I relate it in a personal, human fashion, not just statistics and generals and the cause and effect and the end result. There's human beings caught up in something that they probably didn't ask for. But there they were, caught up in this whirlpool. And it would become the common denominator of their existence. And for that matter, this country's existence. So that's why when I look at it, when I research it, and when I try to instruct or teach or present, it's a story.
Well, we're visiting with Fred Kiger. We're talking about the Civil War, now the Second World War. We're talking about those things that bring us together. And he and I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Fred Kiger. Fred and I are talking about his work as, you know, the most inspiring and preeminent Civil War historian.
You're kind. Thank you.
And doing it in the context of the sort of the end of the 150th remembering
yep.
of the Civil War. I for me, it's been the commemoration of the Civil War in this 150th look back is much different for me than the 100th anniversary because mm-hmm. I was a little older than you, but growing up at that time and real excited about it. Although we had begun the civil rights movement during that time, really there was not, in my mind, there was not much ambiguity about it in terms of the celebration of Robert E. Lee and
certainly.
Stonewall Jackson and the great Confederate heroes and the
South's going to rise again.
South will rise again. Save your Confederate
exactly
money.
Right.
And looking back into family histories and being proud of any connective link that we could have with a Confederate soldier. That's different this time a little bit in my family. I knew that what we were fighting about, that I was on the wrong side. But that didn't keep me from being
sure
fighting for my local or being associated with the people from my family who were associated with that venture. Now, 50 years later, we've gone through a tremendous change in attitudes, particularly about race and about responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Accountability.
For that. And I think I told you the other day, there's no question that if we had to choose sides when I was growing up, we were going to be
sure.
Rebels.
Mm-hmm.
My seven-year-old, who's had loves to set up battle scenes, asked me the other day which side I was on, and when I told him, he said, "Were you were for slavery?"
Oh, yep.
And
that's the immediate association.
He's it's a great question to ask. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we? Are you encountering much of this sort of?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, I have to approach every research and every presentation with that in mind, and understandably so. You know, I think the word is not celebration of the sesquicentennial. It is a commemoration. And it was a very, very difficult time for particularly African Americans as well as white Americans in North and South because of being locked into civil war. You know, we passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the so-called Civil War Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th to end slavery, the 14th to give citizenship, and the 15th to establish the right of suffrage to African Americans. But by 1877, with the return of many local state governments in the South and the nation as a whole turning its attention to expansion and business and Gilded Age and the stock market and what have you, D.G., the first American president to pick up and champion the cause of American civil rights after Abraham Lincoln was not until John F. Kennedy. It took 100 years. And even then, as you will well remember, Kennedy didn't have the ability or the support to get those measures through. It took his assassination and the experienced whip and leadership of LBJ to come in and do what we should have done years and years and years before, Civil Rights Act of 1964, Voting Rights Act of 1965. But even then again, a law is only as strong as it is enforced. And in many respects, we're still trying to figure this all out. If one thinks the American Civil War is pure history, the type of history that you close the book and you put on the shelf, it is the farthest from that circumstance. The issues, states' rights, federal rights, equality for all citizens, white, black, men, women, the list goes on and on and on. We're still trying to figure that all out. We're still trying to figure out that phrase in Mr. Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. Now, at the time he wrote it, it pretty much was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant landowners.
Males.
Exactly. Thank you. But today, well, it's inclusive.
Well, it's how do you deal with that? One way is just to say, look, we have to thank Jefferson for those words.
Certainly.
We have a more expansive meaning for him than maybe he had, or maybe he didn't have in the back of his mind. Maybe he hadn't expanded. But we have to thank those people. We can't, or can we, demonize them for living in their times at the same time without those words? Where would we be as a
country? No, I understand. I understand, and I agree. It doesn't excuse, but necessary steps to hopefully get to a point where we try to make the present better. We try to make, more importantly, the future better, to the point that we can all move forward.
Well, let me ask you this. This is now an ongoing argument that I think will be with us probably for the rest of our lives. And I wonder why the people of my generation, most of my friends are totally resistant to any proposal to change the names of buildings or to take down monuments. More and more I've come to understand a little bit more than I ever did before.
Sure.
How some of these associations with those times that began to be changed by the Civil War are so offensive to the people who suffered by them. Is there a generational difference in how we react to?
I think probably so. I think so. I understand. I understand the concern. I understand the feelings. I do wish, DG, that a lot of those folks would spend that energy on trying to help the present and help those in the future rather than spending all the energy and time trying to change something that's in the past and we can't do anything about it. But we can do something about right now. We can do something about people who are going to be coming along the next 2, 3, 4 generations. But then you and I are Southerners and our skin is white.
I know it. Well, you're rescuing me from a little bit of hopelessness about what's going to happen. Something happened to me that made me think, well, maybe this new generation will figure out a way to do it. But and this is with respect to the great Broadway production of Hamilton.
Oh, exactly.
And so here we have, this great divide. The idea that you'd have a black person playing George Washington, that you'd have a Puerto Rican playing Alexander Hamilton, and that the stage would be mixed up in a celebration of the creation of our country by white men, all of a sudden everybody's involved.
But that's the beauty of where we are today. This country is not all about simply white males. This country is Italian and Puerto Rican, Latino, Orientals, African Americans, men, women. That's what this country is. We've always called ourselves the melting pot. That's probably the most apropos description that we could probably have today. Maybe we're past melting pot. We're stew. We are a stew of many spices and many flavors, if you will. And that's the beauty of what makes this country so great today.
Well, I was so this is the question for you. Could you imagine that this similarly, could the wonderful creator of Hamilton come up with the Civil War story in which we would have, you know, African-American playing Robert E. Lee and maybe, you know, some Chinese guy playing Stonewall Jackson?
You know what?
Or as a woman and go through so that we could really—
I would welcome that. I would applaud that. I will never forget, DG, and forgive me for the aside, but I think it relates. I used to do a simulation when I was teaching at Chapel Hill High School. For 2 weeks, I would place my three Civil War classes in the roles of one class was the executive and judicial branches in 1860. Another class was the Congress, as in the House of Representatives, and another class was the Senate. And we would go through, I gave them the names, and they were the representatives, and they were to do the research and to enact and to reenact, if you will, the roles of these people in 1860. I will never forget, I had one African-American student who asked me, could he be Jefferson Davis, senator from Mississippi? And I looked at him and I said, Andrew, is that really what you want to do? And he went, I want to understand. And I said, you need not say anything more. I applaud you. You go for it.
How did that work out?
Fantastic.
So
fantastic.
He was able to put himself in Jefferson Davis'
shoes. He stepped away from after the experience, certainly not agreeing, but understanding the realm and the role, and it gave him a better perspective about this whole thing that we call American history and the journey that it has required of us to get where we are today.
I'm visiting with Fred Kiger. We're talking about the Civil War and a few other things, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Fred Kiger is my guest. If you joined us late, we've been talking about the Civil War and about things that have a tangential relationship to the Civil War.
Yeah, in many respects, I guess, still going on.
I'm still of a mind to wonder what the commemoration or the observance of the 200th anniversary of the Civil War will be like. Now, I'm not gonna. I might make it, but not likely.
I'm hoping so.
not likely to make it, but we'll be anticipating it. Will the Civil War, now that we have moved towards a racial reconciliation, have come to an agreement that maybe we were fighting for the wrong values and that we're trying to is there a possibility that we
Definitely so, DG. In fact, this sesquicentennial commemoration was very, very different from the centennial. And the centennial, as you mentioned earlier, we're celebrating U.S. Grant and Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And if you were in the South, tracing ancestors and wearing little gray kepes and running around with your pop gun rifled musket and talking about battles and who won and who lost. This last time, we were talking more about the issues that were intricately a part of the American Civil War, and that's African Americans as slaves, African Americans as freedmen, the role of women in the American Civil War. It wasn't just about battles. It wasn't just about males in uniform. It was about so many other issues of which were absolutely important as to how a nation could go to war or those involved caught within the framework of Civil War. The 200th, the bicentennial, I would see it as a continuation of where we are now in the sense of what was it like to be a freedman in the South while the war is whirling around you? What's it like to be an African-American who may be a freedman in the North? What's it like for a woman to be in a hospital somewhere behind the lines, North or South? What about those who deserted? What about those Quakers in North Carolina who were anti-Confederate or lukewarm to the Confederacy, who shielded deserters and who opened their arms to Union prisoners who might have escaped from a prisoner of war camp and trying to make their way back north? It won't just be about battles and about men who had stars on their shoulders or on their collars. It'll be a very inclusive. You can't fight a war without an entire population, for the most part, ground in the machinery of what makes war possible. Mm-hmm. And that goes back, you know, I have friends who maintain it was all about states' rights. It's all about states' rights. And I want to go, guys, to have war, you must upset the people who have power, who have the ability to bring about political change, in this instance, leading to secession. And who were the men in the South who had power? It was more than likely, more times than not, slave owners who may be using states' rights, but let's strip away the veneer and they're protecting their property and slavery. So once we have secession, and once those shots are fired at 4:30 in the morning of April the 12th, 1861, and now there is civil war, now for all those men who are going to enter the Union armies or the Confederate armies, now I will say the whole reason why those men went to fight, the book opens entirely. It's not all about, not every Southern soldier went to war to protect slavery. Not every Northern soldier went to war to end slavery. But to have secession and get us to the doorstep of civil war, you can't ignore it was all about property, slavery.
Well, one thing that happened in this 150th time that I noticed in the – we're talking about the great differences between the 100th and the 150th is that more of my friends were coming along saying, I had my great granduncle. He was really – or he was a deserter and he came home, mm-hmm. or he was a he fought for the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And there was more – that would have been unthinkable that people would have said that on the, during the time.
More a sense of reality and realism as opposed to trying to find a hero in the back in the back room of every home in the South or North. You're exactly right. More a reality of that whole experience that war includes, that civil war, unfortunately, teaches us. There'll be far more open parameters and open avenues for research of far more, many more areas of what allows a nation to go through 4 years of American Civil War. It won't just be about battles and who won or who lost.
Well, Fred Kiger, thank you very much. We just got a minute or two, and for people who joined us late, I'd said you were through with the teaching about the Civil War, but you got more Civil War, and then what comes after the Civil War?
Well, that's a great question. DG, we're also going to include a few other classes as well as Reconstruction next fall and early spring, but some events that had great significance to that period of American history in the late 19th century, the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, Custer's Last Stand, the building of the Brooklyn Bridge, Statue of Liberty, the nation's centennial in 1876. And then after that, it appears that the General Alumni Association and I will be off into a little bit of a different theme, and we're going to start doing classes that will have a common backbone, and that will be North Carolina state history.
I can't wait.
Well, DG, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you, my friend. My best to Harriet.
Oh, thank you, Fred Kiger. Thanks for your what you've given us today and for inspiring us to look back into our background and find out what kinds of things about those things can inspire us to do better today. You're a great hero.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you, DG.
Thanks to you for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.